So this is the second talk on wise speech. There'll be a third talk on wise speech. And this talk and the next talk are a little more subtle dharma. And I say that not as a way for people to turn themselves off thinking that they're just beginners and they have nothing to get out of this topic, rather as a way for you to hopefully stretch up to where the talk is pointing. And I like to offer talks that allow all of us, no matter what our level of experience, to move up to the words so that we can ascend ourselves beyond the usual and normal and ways that we listen to speech. In this case, we have been looking at speech in the first talk in terms of its just as general impact and how it is that we hold a particular view and intention in life. But how our speech can interrupt that view or throw it completely off track, or it can act as a binding force to further the intentionality of that view and actually work to bring things together, which is the view that we hold. And a single word out of the mouth can have a dramatic effect on the receiver, the listener of that word, and to be able to take responsibility for the words that we use and how we use them is really what wise speech is meant to, its orientation is. But it also has an impact on us because it really tells the story of our inward wisdom in that moment, doesn't it? However, there can be speech that is so conditioned and with it is so ensconced in a particular perception of the world that we may not even have the clarity to know what we're saying in that moment in the view from which we are talking from. Now that is very important to understand the power of the word itself. So I just want to start off tonight and talk just a little bit about the power of a word, any word, and that it has an emotional impact. It can have a whole orientation to life, a whole intentionality to life. I mean, I can just, if I just took a political word like Republican or Democrat, suddenly there's an arousal. I'm sure if we had an electroencephalogram on you, we could find all kinds of spikes and valleys by just naming certain names of leadership. Which is entirely, it's entirely a conceptual relevance, has no real truth, has no true reality in this moment, except the reality that we've intoned in it, intoned within that word. And so we offer the word the reality. We offer the word our heart, really, when really where our heart wants to infuse itself is, and where spiritual practice ultimately points, is free from the mental persuasion, the mental confiscation of things, free from mental influence. And yet we keep investing in the mental influence, in the words we use, and lose our way within those words. And to understand the difference between a word and the reality is really much of what Dharma practice, the orientation of Dharma practice. And I've given you various methods and tools to begin to know that. Meditation itself is a way for us to discern the difference between what reality is as it impinges on our senses and what reality is when we open our eyes and form a view out of those sense, out of that sense data. And to begin to get a sense of how we create this response and reaction to the world, how we build our, as the Buddha said, the entire world exists within this fathom-long body. No, I mean, let's just look at a very simple word, perhaps the simplest word that we have in the dictionary, I. What does that point to? Where is it really pointing? What is the reality behind that word? We assume it all the time. We speak about it, from it, towards it all the time. It holds a very firm view and relationship to me. Everything is external. So we have a whole reference that we, and understanding that we have around that word. An enormous amount of baggage called our story, assumption, a lifestyle, an image. But what is the reality of it? And to understand the difference between the reality to the placeholder, the functional placeholder, that is necessary to talk about I, me, and mine, but not as a reference to something that's true, not as a reference to something that is solid and steady. But we have lost our way within that. And from time to time, just begin to ask oneself, am I so sure I know what this is, this sense of I? Am I so convinced in it? I mean, I'm convinced in its history, but what is it that's living this history? What is it that records the history? What is it that knows the history? What is it that sees the history? What is it that lives the history, that bees the history? How about starting there? See, you suddenly get very quiet, don't you? And when you get quiet, you lose the words. When we lose the words, we lose the symbol and the organizational principle from which the symbol projects outward. We get very quiet. Without that assumption, we all get very quiet. And so when we assume the sense of I to be real, then we have a real problem when we talk about our spiritual work. You see, what I want to point to tonight is the way we use words to create the problem for our spiritual journey to fix. We're creating the problem, and then we go on a spiritual journey to fix the problem that we created. And that it can, the use of words, when they're assumed to be true without really looking to the reality behind which they point, hold a whole strategy of life in which we try to work out our salvation from the assumptions that have never really been tested. Is that wise speech? So much, really, what the practice does is take us deeper and deeper into what wise speech really is. Into the discernment of what we're really talking about as we speak. And not just to assume its truth because everyone else is. And that we've been told that our whole life. So let us explore the Dharma language. And I want to explore the Dharma language in two general drifts tonight. The first one that I'll start off is the Dharma language of change. The Dharma language of change means that I'm evolving into something. Right? So when I talk about the Dharma language of change, I mean the sense of this me evolving into, through spiritual practice and how it helps me and how it adds to me, how I cultivate and how I change in my spiritual work. Now, an interesting, I had a beginning class last night, and one of the women in the class said, I came here for a particular reason, and now you're telling me that all reasons are fruitless. And she was about to leap to the door. And I said, it's not that we don't all have goals. We all of us have a reason that we're sitting, don't we? We all have a point to this. Now let me, I need to bring everybody along in this talk. No matter where you are in the evolution of these different references for your practice, it doesn't matter. Neither of them are wrong. This is an evolution of understanding. And I just want to show you the value and limitation of the perceived, of each of the perspectives. You know, we're ready to go to the more nobler perspective. We want to be in high school, we want to be in college, but every perspective has a downside to it. And so we just want to look at this thing and take it apart a little bit. I like doing this. Okay, right? So this question of change, this sense that we're in evolution, we're in movement, we're in evolution towards something. We're growing towards. And that we're abiding in time, fair enough? I mean, if we're moving towards something, we're abiding in time. We're going from here to there. And we start out here. We start out full of whatever we want to, however we classify ourselves. Ignorance, confusion. I don't know how we do it. And then we have we get full of practices. We love practices because practices, we believe, allow us to move through the journey using the practices to cultivate certain qualities in us. And we even get a sense of accomplishment within those practices, and we get a sense of mileposts along the way that we change from and into. None of this is wrong. All of this has a relativity of truth. Right? All of it is around the assumption of me. I'm changing. Now, it's very interesting because I just want to stop here and just show you a few things. See, when you're actually sitting down, you don't see yourself as a solid block. You're not a piece of granite. If you look at yourself, if you look at your mind, and perhaps every one of you have had this experience, there's nothing in there that's fixed. I mean, this is, from the very beginning, you get a sense of this. That there isn't any place that you can stand and claim ownership. Everything is in movement. Everything is in transition. Now, somehow we see that, but we relate to ourselves as something that needs construction. Something that needs some molding. Something that needs something done to itself. Now, does a process, which is what we see when we look inside, does that need construction? It's only an entity that needs construction. A process doesn't need construction. A process is in construction itself. It's in movement all the time. You see, it's how we have always referenced ourselves. We're not letting the reality of what we see in. We're not, when we sit down and we don't see ourselves being a solid thing, why don't we then assume that particular equation of self rather than the one that we have lived with and assumed all along the way, that I am somehow stable and an entity, a thing in all of this. So the seeds of what I'm saying to you are already present in every one of your practice. But the assumptions can be so strongly conditioned and not, so that we're not really allowing reality to show us anything new, especially about me. And so we carry this sense of me early on for an extended length of time into our meditation. And we do things which we think are helpful to the sense of me. We cultivate qualities, all very appropriate to do. We practice kindness, patience with ourselves. We perhaps ascribe to an ethical life, and we practice that as well. We try to warm our heart and get our heart moving. And we do all this very much with a sense of trying to alter or chisel away at this hardened sense of me that seems to follow me no matter where I go. And we invest considerable time into the evolution of this sense of me. And it has considerable validity in the sense that I can see myself changing. I can see myself getting to be more responsive, less reactive, more attentive, better able to listen, warmer heart. Beautiful qualities. And it also fits a kind of Dharma understanding that everything changes and I'm changing along with everything and that I'm molding and moving myself along. And so I seem to fit this equation of impermanence, although there's something in me that I won't quite allow impermanence to touch, but never mind. The qualities of me seem to be changing, which is good enough. The problem is that I keep thinking of myself as incomplete and lacking in some way, which is why I constantly need to force the effort to change. And that very much fits our national character. I just want us to get a sense of how the logic around this is also a national logic, whether you're in the Dharma or not. Because the sense of self-improvement, the sense of being self-reliant and taking yourself and being anything you want to be, the sense of ambition and striving for goals is very much a part of the economic, cultural milieu in which we live. It's what we have been inducted into. And so this sense of self-movement, of moving and changing and evolving, this sense of me and evolution, this sense of change, Dharma change, is fits perfectly the culture we live in. But what we're saying as we're moving is what is present now isn't it. That's the assumption of movement. What I have here and now is not enough, is not it. And so in some way we're denying Dharma in our need to change. You get a sense of that? Because the Dharma is really where we finally rest, where there is a final contentment, must be here and now. But if we're not allowing ourselves to come to that final rest because we think that the final rest is in the future after we have molded ourselves sufficiently so that we can change and then rest, how many of us have come to that point? How many of us, except for a few minutes, perhaps feel that sense of contentment in ourselves? That the contentment should be everlasting. This is what the Dharma promises. It doesn't promise a momentary glance of contentment. If it were, then we would all be leaning forward all the time to regain and renew that contentment. And we would never be settled. And we can also see that there's no real seeing that's going on. The scene is futuristic. It's not what I am now, it's what I'm going to become through my efforts, through my persuasion, through my cultivations. And after a time, the language of change promises wisdom and freedom. The language of change does that. And purification. It's fine until as long as we're working on qualities of self. But it gets a little shaky when we bring in the deeper aspects of Buddhism. When we bring in the deeper aspects of Buddhism, like emptiness, or selflessness, or suchness, the Tathagata is another name for the Buddha, Tathagata. Tathagata means suchness, suchness. It's a beautiful term. Then the language of change and the assumptions associated with it and the strategies that accompany it and the view and intention from it. You see, this is a package deal. Suddenly it begins to break down. And over time, as we watch our mind again and again and find no solidity of person there, we begin to wake up out of the language of change. It's a natural evolution out of a particular confinement of view that we have held ourselves to because we have always believed in. We've always invested in it. We awaken out of time. We no longer are convinced that time will carry is the salvation. And this inherent sense of inadequacy, this pain that has been driving the need for my salvation in time, away from myself, so that I can grow into something much better and more pure than I feel to be now. And the pain of that begins to be felt. Have you felt it yet? The rub, inherent and evolving. And it's interesting because insights are beginning to happen at a certain point in our evolution as we evolve that we would rather not own. We never not accept. And those are beginning to show us the limitation of the view we have held within our spiritual practice that has kept us evolving. We feel the pain. And we are very reluctant to share that because we think it exposes us as a fake, as a mistake. And we feel a mistake inside, and to expose ourselves spiritually as a mistake and have that taken away, we have nothing left. So the last thing I want to tell or say to anyone is how difficult I'm feeling in this need to constantly press ahead in my spiritual journey. So these insights begin to show us the limitation of the language of change. The language of change. Understand how embedded the language of change is in our psyche. Understand that it's inherent in the assumption of a solid self. It's the only way the solid self can navigate itself through the path of a spiritual awakening. Thinking of itself as moving, of evolving out of itself into something new. And that evolution is founded in resistance. It's resistance to being who we are because we don't want to be, we don't want to have to rest with the sense of inward failure and inward inadequacy that we feel. That's what we're moving away from. That's what our evolution is out of. So it's a movement away from who we are, and it's a movement from not wanting to see what we are. It's because there's too much fear in that. And insights begins to show us that. It begins to show us that we, when we sit down in the base core, after we have gone through the display of magic that the mind gives us in terms of its fantasy and its persuasive dreamlike quality and its enamored states of mind which come up, and after we have journeyed perhaps for a long period of time within those chambers which offer some possibility of being someone other than what I am, if I can have that quality of subtlety and serenity, maybe I'm not the miserable person I believe myself to be. So let me just keep going that direction. That offers me some relief, or at least some hope of getting out of this thing. So then we get tired of the language of change. We get fed up with it. It's not that we begrudge it. We grow out of it. Our understanding grows out of it. It's like this hurts. And suddenly it dawns on us that Buddhism is supposed to end the hurt. So maybe I'm hurting myself by the very assumptions I've held myself within. What do I have to do? I have to give up these assumptions. But I'm not quite willing to give up the language. I'm willing to move to a different form of language and take on those assumptions. So now what's left? What's the next bar I can run to? How about to immediacy? The language of immediacy. I love that one. Now we're out of change. Now it's all right here. Words like natural radiance of mind, Buddha nature, intrinsic freedom, or in Christian terms, the kingdom within. Now, that's a nobler cause. And not only that, I have a kind of judgment about those who are still evolving. I'm out of that. You're still doing that, huh? Yeah. And we can speak from this philosophy of language because it feels so true. Each of the assumptions feels true in the way that life is presenting itself and all the ways that we can show that we are changing. From the point of view, from the language of change, we can convince ourselves scientifically, objectively, yes, I was here and now I'm there. And you can even look at me on some kind of personality inventory and I can show you a shift. So don't tell me it doesn't work. You see, we have a whole way to satisfy our doubt. And so too in the language of immediacy. Now, it's only now. It's all now. Drop your story. Disgust. And our insights showed the limitation of change. So this is the natural place where my next assumption can land. It can land in immediacy. So we say, this is where I want to go towards immediacy. Words are still holding a predominance of truth to us. And we're just shifting reference points. Remember that each reference point from the advantage of those assumptions feels completely valid. So you can't talk yourself out of a particular reference point. You can only insightfully see through that reference point. You can't convince yourself to move forward. you can only see your way out of the difficulty. And that takes an enormous amount of sincerity. There's no other word that, because you have to be willing to be humble and see where you have spent your time looking and where you have, from the point of view, when you see that the language of change no longer authenticates the assumptions that we've held, it's tremendously humbling because, well, what have I been doing? What the sense of self does from that is, I've been wasting my time. I've been wasting my time. And you feel hopeless. We feel despondent. Oh, I've been wasting my time. That's really coming from the same assumption of the language of change, but it hasn't gotten down into the cellular qualities and integrated sufficiently so that we even see the illogic of saying that to ourselves. So we can be a terribly difficult time as we evolve through insight out of this particular way we have held ourselves to be. And we begin to see that there is only now. And that everything else is thought. And everything else is thought has no reference in reality. We see that. And as we see that, we understand that it's either dealing directly with this mind and body as it is, in this moment, as it is, not waiting for it to evolve into something, but as it is, completely as it is, that there'll really be any breakthrough of wisdom. Even those of you who are still embedded in the language of change, and I am not in any way suggesting that you just change tongues, change language, can feel the truth of that last statement. If you're willing to see the truth of that last statement, you will begin to see the confinements, the way that the language of change keeps us imprisoned, because it's never about now. By the very assumptions it's based, it's never about now. Now is something we have to endure when we sit. Now this language of immediacy is full of pitfalls because it's just another assumption we are making. See, did you think I was going to let you rest? Did you think I was going to give you a language in which you could rest upon? Do you think that is the teaching? We take the most sacred thing and we throw it like a crystal glass against the fireplace. That's what it means to be alive. And so we have to look at the assumptions associated with this language of immediacy. As convincing as it is, it's so convincing. But if it remains a philosophy, then it will be pitted against the language of change. And those two will always be in conflict with one another. And the Dharma will have nothing to do with conflict. Nothing. So, what are some of the pitfalls in this language of immediacy? Well, when I look around, some things do have to change, don't they? In fact, one of the most misunderstood ways that we hold the Dharma is we say, be with things as they are. And somebody who was in an abusive relationship came to me after years of being a student and said that she had remained in this abusive relationship because the teaching was to be with things as they are. And that she realized that her reactivity to this abuse was something, any movement from that was just aversion. And so she was going to stay in the relationship because that was the Dharma thing to do. That's the befuddlement that one sees when something is so misunderstood or clung to. It is not about staying in a self-damaging, deprecating relationship to life. Some things have to change, and that's one of them. And when your heart's engaged really in the Dharma, you wouldn't stay a minute in that relationship. Not a minute. So, one of the pitfalls of this immediacy is that it can keep you in a very dysfunctional relationship to your life, where you don't seek change. Another pitfall. Parts of us do need to be cultivated. But the language of immediacy allows none of that. In fact, I have heard spokespeople from the language of immediacy ridicule meditation itself. Because any time you sit, you've got a problem. There's no problem. Just be what you already are and stop sitting. So the language pulls the rug out from any sense of cultivation at all, or any tools or any methods whatsoever. And yet, all of us realize that there are qualities of mind and heart that are nourished as we sit. And that those qualities start strengthening the ability to see and the insights we do have. And without those qualities, we have so much distractibility and confusion in our mind, we see nothing. And so we just hold on to the philosophy of immediacy. We don't really see from immediacy. So cultivation is important. I want you to feel the paradoxes of this. It's not the fact that we are infusing one stance as opposed to another. It's in taking a stance at all. That's the problem. It's the language and how it holds us in a stance. That's the problem. Then there's another character development, may I say. What all of us have done for a lot, long part of our sitting history is extremely important. Because in your character, as you develop it, you provide more and more safety for other people to grow out of themselves into their integration, into their integrity, into their truth. You represent a safe haven, a safe harbor for other people to be able to move outside of what their own bondage. And you begin to see that we're all in this together. That's why social engagement is not just something we do because we feel good about it. It is how our hearts invest in bringing everybody through this inevitable process of growth. Lots of what Buddha talked about was about character development. The ability to provide safe environment, a safe psychic environment for others to be able to move out of themselves, to grow out from the bondage of their own language. The fourth pitfall of the language of immediacy is that we can ridicule and not take responsibility at all. It's all illusion. You see? It's all illusion. When it's only now, then any thoughts of us, any thoughts of the world existing outside of now, in future or in past, become illusory. And therefore, it doesn't really, morality, ethical conduct doesn't really matter, because it's all empty. What kind of world? Do you want to live in that world? You see? Also, when not completely understood, all of this is the philosophy of the language and how it gains momentum, and how quickly we will move out of the bondage and hurt from the language of change to just to form another bondage with the language of immediacy. But at least I don't have to hurt like I did when I was trying to cultivate and change myself. Now at least I'm in a new and seemingly more free set of terms, not realizing that that set of terms has its own pitfalls, its own bondage. And this bondage now is that I don't have to take responsibility for myself at all. In fact, I feel more noble, a little higher, a little pride, perhaps, but uplifted. And I can circumvent myself because myself is nothing. I don't even have to deal with that pain. I can frolic and not have to look where I'm in most need of looking. The Dalai Lama was once asked, "You speak so much of kindness," someone said. "What about emptiness? Why not pursue emptiness?" He said something very wise. He said, "Kindness is safer." The language of immediacy, it can be so destructive. Kindness is safer. Kindness keeps your feet on the ground. Kindness keeps you looking in the other's eyes. It keeps you feeling your own pain of engaged interaction. And if it means cultivating kindness, then so be it. Let us be very wary of the cold and stark wasteland of immediacy when it is spoken about as a philosophy. The problem with all of these is the language you're using. The language does not hold the reality. It holds a fixed response to the reality. And so whatever language we're using, don't take it as an absolute. Don't take it as the assumption of how the world really is. Use it as a relative tool for yourself. Use it as a way to help yourself in a particular form of pain you might be in. You'll want to use skillful means. Skillful means moving from this to that. So be it. And we use the language of change in order to do that. So be it. And then always question the very language use itself, the very way that we're holding the world, the very view that we're in. Always question that. No matter what we find in terms of insight. Because insight will bring forth a new language. When you see, the seeing doesn't have language, but the mind then captures the seeing and puts a new assumption and view around that particular insight. And then we're off and running not from the insight, but from the view, the language, the insight has imparted. We're after insight, not reforming the world. And any time there is a language that's set, there will be conflict, because your set of terms will have to be in discord to someone else's. and you will be in the same fixed, although you may feel more noble, you will be just as imprisoned. This versus that. Absolute versus relative. That's relative. That's just time versus timeless. The Buddha said, however one can conceive the truth, it is other than that. I could have just said that, and that would have been the whole talk. May we all follow that. Can we sit just for a minute or two? However one is conceiving the truth, as we sit, watch the mind attempt to conceive the truth in a certain way. Who you are in relationship to what is being heard, or however we configure the world in this moment, let it just rest in space between the logs. Let it just rest. Don't affirm it. You feel it? The reality of a new dimension? That which lies below the language. What does the relative or the absolute have to do with that? Nothing. What does time or timeless or argument or resistance have to do with that? Nothing. What does a stance, a persuasion have to do with that? Nothing. In fact, language can't touch it. So when we take ourselves to be so credible and so sure, just pause and look. What are we basing that assumption on? Okay, if anyone has any questions or comments, I would be happy to try to answer. Yes.
So it seems like immediacy can happen in the flow of change. So rather than myself fixating on this is what it is, can't they both
coexist? Yeah. Yes, they do coexist. They coexist as long as you aren't within the language. Right? When you are within the language and the assumptions of the language, then it's impossible for them to coexist. Do you see? Because the language barricades out the other reality. The language is a perspective. It is a way of seeing. It's one perspective. It's like a piece of a pie. You're not getting the whole story. You're getting the assumption associated with that view. And so if you suspend the view, you no longer have a piece of the pie, you have the whole pie. If you're wordless, if you're quiet with yourself, you don't come from any perspective. It's not like you have to defend anything. All you have to do is just be the moment. Abide in the moment. Which is where wordlessness will naturally have you abide. And so you're not taking a stake against reality in any way whatsoever. We're not fighting the opposite view. We're just we don't take a stance anywhere in that. There's no fixation in that. Do you see that a little bit?
So sometimes, as you're going through, as I'm going through today, right. Sometimes you get the feeling that things are kind of passing you.
Yes.
And then sometimes it's just the opposite. It's like there's friction.
Yes.
It's just odd.
Yes. So sometimes it feels as if things are passing you and you're just moving right along with things, right? It's all change. And sometimes it feels like there's resistance. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so when there is resistance, relax. Relax the resistance. Because that's where you're forming a language in opposition to reality. That's where you've taken yourself out of as an idea. This shouldn't be happening. This isn't supposed to occur. I wanted this to be. That's where the resistance is always going to be found, is in the middle mental framework of a reality that you've created that's in conflict with the one that's actually transpiring. So with your willingness to not resist, it means you're giving up your fantasy of wanting a better life in that moment, which is the language of wanting to take yourself out of the life you're in. And when you give up that language, the resistance will end and you'll find yourself back into the flow and movement harmoniously with everything that is, even though it may be an unpleasant moment. So as we distill all of this down into a very simple equation, it's relax, observe, and allow. Resistance is the message, is the indicator that we're not relaxing, observing, and allowing. And if we can actually abide in life so that we continually relax the resistance we're in, we'll find ourselves abiding more and more within the harmony, not outside the harmony. Does that make some sense? Okay. Yes.
I guess the point where my mind is getting stuck, basically the same point, just going over from a different angle, is it seems as soon as you acknowledge that something isn't working or that there is a need to change, then your mind immediately goes forward into the future where that change can be made, or when that time will come, when that's no longer dealing with that specific situation, and that seems to then release your
presence. Right. Yes.
I guess I'm wondering, how does one acknowledge the need for change or evolution and still maintain the presence?
How does one acknowledge the need to change and still maintain the presence? Present. It's a difference between being enslaved within the words or being informed by the possibility of the possibilities available. See, it's how you use the mind. It's not that the mind is a wrong machine to use. It's just that when we get lost in the thoughts that this reality should not be happening, we're giving 100% over to that alternative, and almost none of us is abiding in the reality that is displeasing to us. That's being lost within the language. Okay? The other possibility is being able not to resist whatever it is that's going on, but that doesn't mean I don't go to the thermostat and turn the heat down. It doesn't mean that I stay within an abusive relationship. It doesn't in any way deter relative action. Usually that relative action will come from injustice, or the feeling of the heart of something being of of wanting to serve or engage life in such a way that it brings things closer together, rather than just self-serving comfort or indulgence. And one's own sense of self is also served with kindness, not indulgence. So if we're being abused, I'm not going to let that happen. Why would I let that happen? That's not self-kind. I'm out of here. So it's better to move with the word kindness. You see, we're trying to figure out how to make this thing work prior to living within the reality in which it does work. And therefore, we're just bringing forth another language, even in our questions, which will ultimately lead to a kind of a psychic map or blueprint of what to do when this occurs, I do this. But that's not the teaching. The teaching is to get us to the wordless and let the heart respond out of that particular intonation. Okay, I don't know what I would do if this were happening. People would love to present some kind of boxed-in theory. Well, if you were in the relationship I was in and you don't know, what would you do? I have no idea. How would I possibly know that? No one could possibly know what anyone would do within any situation until they're there. And then you just, whatever is the appropriate thing to do, that's what you do. So it's not as if action becomes befuddled or confused. It's completely obvious, completely appropriate. Oh, this is, okay, this is, there's nothing that's been said at all that says, don't do the appropriate thing. See, we constantly go to the language for our journey, for the specifics of our journey. We look for the language for the specifics of our journey. How do I take a step this way? It's because we're so unsure of ourselves. We have such little confidence. We feel like there's so much at stake that we want some assurance that the next step is going to be in the right direction. And so we have very little confidence in our manifestation of intrinsic freedom. To live more and more in the not knowing than the assurance of a map is where the teaching takes us, step by step. It takes us out of language. It takes us more into the not knowing. And that not knowing is not a confusing not knowing. It's only confusing to the sense of self that's trying to navigate with language through the not knowing. When that sense of self is opened up to the space between the logs, it's not confusing at all. It's clear. And what the appropriate thing is very easily discerned. Yes.
I don't know why this just happened tonight, but I just realized that most of the language in my life never gets out. It's never uttered. It stays up here. So if you use that idea that, is this are these words of kindness in here or words of love?
Yes. Good. Go to your heart. Don't try to do it from here. There will be judgment from here. I'm not kind enough. I should be kinder. And what's wrong with that? You see, you're looking towards the wrong organ. You go down a foot and you go, oh, you let your heart engage in yourself. Oh, what I've been doing to myself is very unkind. That's not a judgment. That's just seeing. Wow, this is very unkind. Why am I doing that to myself? You see, the tone changes considerably. The seeing, you'll still see what you're doing to yourself, but it won't come from a backlash or it won't come from a reactivity. It'll come from, oh, whoa, how come I'm doing this? My God, I don't want to do that to myself. Right? That's the language of kindness, and that cultivation will take us more and more into the heart. more and more into the unknowing, more and more into the sense of Braille, of a spiritual path is really the path of the blind, of Braille. Not, I don't know. What am I going to do what am I going to do after this is, what am I going to say? I have no idea. Nothing. I have nothing. I have 15 minutes to fill. I have no idea how to fill it. You see? How can we stay there? Can we stay there? Just try, just do it, because you don't have anything to lose. You have it, once you see that how other people are thinking of you has no bearing whatsoever on you, none, then you have nothing to lose. Okay, 15 minutes. I don't know a damn thing. What am I going to do? Any other questions? I don't know. It just also kind of works its way. And it's really just taking your seed in a different organ. Really. It's just this thing. You're never going to find salvation in the mind. I hope by now we're beginning to see that. It just doesn't work itself out. It's the organ of language. It's the organ of words. It is an important organ. I mean, it's very important to know that you're biting into a sandwich and not a piece of wood. It's a very important organ. But it isn't the consummate organ. It isn't what makes it all work. This is the organ that makes it all work. This is the one that gets you fed and gets you to work on time and gets you up in the morning. This is the one that the heart is the organ that makes it work. And so you let this one say this, I'm not staying in this. This is a relationship. What a kind of a, this is no good. And that, then you just keep following the heart. You just keep allowing, and kindness is the avenue that can move us from here. Is it kind to judge? Well, I must not be coming from the seat of kindness. If all I'm doing to myself is ridiculing how unkind I am. That's the wrong organ. That must show us something. That sets off some kind of alarm, doesn't it? That we're not in the right organ if all I'm doing is judging myself for how unkind I am. It's the wrong one. It's never going to show us anything but judgment and comparison and contrast, which is the language of change. That's what I mean. And this one will switch to the language of immediacy if it seems appropriate, because it wants to feel more noble. This is the language of silence, where the seed of kindness rests. We come from this organ. It's not a question of, did I do well enough? And I should do better. And if I had it together, I would. It's not that. That's not the language of it. It's the language of a smile. It's the language of a touch. So there can be time for one more question if anyone has one, or then we'll move to announcements. Yes.
I think that using the heart also helps me not to hurry.
Not to hurry.
Yeah.
Yes. She says using the heart helps her not to hurry. I do this simple thing in the morning. I brush my teeth. For 20 years now, I've been telling people to brush their teeth, and just brush their teeth as one of the markers that, so I now do that. And I just can't believe the power of hurry, the power of the conditioned mind's reference to hurry. It has no respect at all for what is occurring. None. Its life, its survival is not in knowing that you're on the back molars with your toothbrush. It wants to spit and get out of there. Just do one act. and watch the mind hurry itself through that. And meet it. Meet that hurry with the resolution of heart that you are not going to hurry. And you'll see how the heart will trump the mind. You'll see the mind convincing you with everything it has that you're wasting time. Okay, you go ahead. You're just wasting your time. And you meet that. You take that. This is resolve. This is a parami. This is a cultivation. You resolve. Okay, now, nope. Back molars, upper left. Do it. And slowly the flames, the intensity of the need to hurry become extinguished within the space around the log. Thank you all.